Here we go. Okay, good evening. Welcome, and thank you for coming. I'm David Kramer. I'm director of the library here at JTS. I know some of you from prior events, those of you whom I have not yet met. Just welcome, and I hope that you'll come back for other such events. We here at the library of JTS consider it a privilege, pleasure, and obligation to bring to the attention of people like yourselves significant new works of Jewish interest of a wide variety of sorts. And it is in that context, and we have, as many of you know, a series featuring new books and their authors or editors, and it's in that context that Beth Kisalev will be speaking about her new book. She is both author of parts of it and editor of the volume as a whole, Reading Genesis, as you know. It's a remarkable collected volume. I've got to say, one thing that one immediately learns about you, Beth, from looking at the volume from the table of contents, is that people have a hard time saying no to you. That's got to be a very special quality, because it is not many people who could bring together a collection of writers like this, all of them significant, commenting in different ways on the themes and questions that arise in a reading of the book of Genesis. And so, there's a lot to be discovered here, and thank you for doing it. I'm looking forward to what you have to say. I asked her when we went out to dinner beforehand, how did you get all these people to say yes? She says, well, that's part of what I'm going to talk about. So in order not to bore you, just wait, and you'll hear me say something about it then. Her bio was on the promotional material that you all saw, so I won't go into details. I'll only say two things here of particular distinction. Beth shared with me that though her new novel is officially scheduled to be published next month, middle of this month, nevertheless, she saw it for the first time on the shelf of a bookstore.
Book Culture,
right here in Morningside Heights. So I don't think it's going to be open after we're finished, but you can come back tomorrow to Book Culture and purchase her new novel called Questioning Return. Sounds like a fascinating novel. She described some of the themes to me beforehand, and I can say that I can't wait to go and get a copy and read it. The other thing I'll say is that of all of her many accomplishments and achievements, which include PhD, various teaching responsibilities, journalistic achievements, all kinds of things, there's no question that the most distinguished achievement she has ever had is to be the valedictorian of JTS's Prose Door High School program in what year was it? In 1985. So we welcome you back to JTS and look forward to what you have to say. I'll only add that after her presentation, which will take 40 to 45 minutes, there'll be time for discussion, questioning, then you will have an opportunity to purchase a copy of the book if you are interested. So Beth, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming. I'm very honored to be here. As Rabbi Kramer said, I did spend 5 years coming here from 8th grade to 12th grade, and in a way, that's where the book starts. So I'm very glad to be here, and thank you for inviting me. So this is a book that comes very much out of JTS, and it's a... Can everyone hear me? This is the mic?
There's no microphone.
Oh, okay.
So you're a teacher right now. You've got to project.
Good. Okay. No problem. No, I was just confused. Okay. This is a book that very much comes out of JTS and its approach to texts and text study. I'll explain. When I was in high school, I went to the Prose Door program here, and I really enjoyed having a chance to study with young, interesting rabbinical students. They were hip. They were up to the moment. There was one, Reuven Greenwald, who I guess he's not here now, but he had been. But he would always, he and I would always discuss books we were reading and share topics and titles and sort of challenge each other to read different things. And it was really, it was a very meaningful experience for me to come here. And I compared it with the learning at my very intellectually challenging high school. Also, I went to Horace Mann, which some of you may know is one of the more academic high schools in the city. I'm not particularly proud of that right now, but we don't have to talk about that. At Horace Mann, one of the things that they did was have a Buddhist English teacher who I really admired at the time and I don't admire now, which is not something I want to get into, but they thought that it would be the best if someone who wasn't Christian or Jewish spoke to us about the Bible. And the reason why we needed to know about the Bible was in order to understand English literature and the allusions in English literature, you need to know Bible, you need to know the sources. And of course, most students today don't have a religious education, so the school was attempting to provide this in some limited way with these exposures to the Bible through lectures from this Buddhist English teacher. And I was one of the few people in the class who knew even enough limited Hebrew at that time to add to what was being discussed. If he said something about Esau and Edom, I said, well, you know, Edom means red, and that's really very important, and that's what the lentil stew was, that it's red, and it's part of Esau. And my knowledge was pretty limited at the time, but it was extensive compared to everybody else. But it really troubled me that I was with a lot of bright and intellectually engaged Jewish kids, and no one cared about Bible. They thought that this was not something that was going to help them get into college, and not something it would help them later in life, and there was really no reason to know more about Bible. And this really bothered me, and I thought, what is wrong with them? Why can't they see how important this is and what a fascinating text this is? And I really wanted to do something to show them that intellectually engaged people, like my teachers at JTS, who were, you know, smart Ivy League graduates, could do anything but chose to devote themselves to Jewish text study, that Jewish text study was something worth doing. So this was something I really wanted to prove to my classmates, and at the time I didn't have a way of doing it, and I am happy to say I feel like this book does that. It brings together a collection of really intellectually engaged Jews to use their intellectual knowledge to talk about the text. And it was really a conflict that I felt at the time, because I was very much enamored of the learning that I was doing at Prosdor, and I was also enamored of the intellectual learning that I was getting in high school. And I really felt this gap between the two, and I hope that my book in some ways was able to close that gap. Always thought that the Bible was a fascinating thing. It has all the elements of a human story. It has family dysfunction, sex, violence, love, hate, anger, jealousy, a dollop of poetry, some profound moral instruction, a chance to catch a break, one day in seven. Everything is there. And recently the Skirball Center on 65th and 5th did a lecture series, Real Housewives of the Bible. And I think all the drama and excitement of any artificial storyline is right there in the Bible. You don't have to look very far to see why it makes sense to title a lecture series about women in the Bible, the Real Housewives of the Bible. But there are a lot of contemporary Jews who don't feel this text is accessible and something that they can comprehend and make part of their everyday life. So I wanted to do something to remedy this. So as I said, really the idea for this book began when I was in high school with this dilemma that I had between the intellectual engagement that I saw at JTS and the intellectual engagement but without moral quality, which is very destructive, that I saw at my high school. So that was something that had bothered me for many years, and fast forward, in the summer of 2007, I was able to spend a week at the Chautauqua Institution in upstate New York. Has anyone been there? Okay, great. Okay, so Chautauqua is a place, it was actually started by Christian clergy as a sort of respite place. You could go and learn in the summer and relax, and now it's has secular topics, but there's also a whole religion department that brings in people doing religious topics, but of all denominations. There's a Chabad there, there's a Jewish center. I recently got the calendar for this year. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks is coming, which should be wonderful, as anything he would do would be. So the week that I was there in 2007, so every week they have a theme and they bring in speakers on that theme. So it was Human Sexuality Week. So the culmination of Human Sexuality Week, lectures are Monday through Friday. Friday was Dr. Ruth Westheimer. Uh-huh. And those of you that have heard her speak, she's very dynamic and terrific. And though her talk wasn't specifically Jewish, it's who she is. So she can't not talk about Judaism because it's very much a part of her. And so she mentioned a number of Jewish ideas and people were very much enamored of everything she said. And at the end of her talk, it was Friday, she said, you know, today is Friday, it's Shabbat this evening, I'm going to be at the Kabbalat Shabbat service at the lake at 5:30. So usually there's 50 people, 60 people. That week there are 250 or 300 people. People just flocked to be with her. And I thought, what is it that we can do to capture some of this energy and enthusiasm and dynamism that's connected to being Jewish? Because here were people coming to a prayer service that wouldn't come otherwise, but wanted to be connected to her and what she was saying in some way. So it was something I had in my mind, and this was August. And a few weeks later, I was speaking with a friend of mine. I was living in Minneapolis at the time, and I belonged, as every good Jew should, I belonged to two synagogues. So I was with my friend, only belonged to one, so he's not as good a Jew as I know. actually, I still belong to two synagogues, so yes. I can say I'm still a good Jew on that measure. So I was talking with my friend, and I was at the synagogue that he was not speaking out on Rosh Hashanah, and I asked him, well, you gave a Devar Torah at this synagogue on Rosh Hashanah. What did you talk about? How did it go? So he is a political science professor at the university, and we were riding bicycles to teach at the university, and he started telling me about his talk for Rosh Hashanah, and it wasn't very interesting. It was what I call a Parsha report, which is Rashi said this, Ramban said that, Ibn Ezra said this, and just a listing of, you know, reporting of everything everyone said. And, you know, okay, that's nice, but for me personally, what I find interesting in a Devar Torah or in any kind of work is a point of view. You know, I like to see a point of view, an opinion, an idea. So he was giving me his Parsha report. I said, okay, you know, great, good work, you know, pat on the back, you're a day school graduate. I'm glad that, you know, your parents' tuition was helpful. And then he started talking to me about his political science ideas as they applied to the Akedah, to the binding of Isaac by Abraham. And he said, well, you know, I really think that Abraham used the weapons of the weak. He used the resistance of the weak. And I mean W-E-A-K, not W-E-E-K. So the less strong. That Abraham didn't really rush to do God's command. That really he was resisting in a way that only weaker people could, because Abraham is mortal, and if God is divine, is giving him a command, it's not possible for him. He's not on the same level as God. It's not possible for him to resist that way, but he was doing what he could as a weaker, lesser person to resist. And he started describing this, and I thought, this is fascinating. I don't know anything about political science. I don't know anything about these theories. And this is really interesting. And what if I put these things together? What if, so at the end of our conversation, he said, oh, you know, that's 1/12 of my book on Genesis. And I said, wait, you're not writing a book on Genesis. I'm the one that wants to write a book on Genesis. I'm going to do that. This is what I'll do, is I will ask, and I've wanted to do something about Bible. My degree is in comparative literature, and I wrote about Bible translations, but I'm really interested in something sort of connected to what Dr. Kramer is, the editor of a journal of
Biblical Reception.
So how the Bible has been received over time. And this is a 3-year-old journal, but if it had been around when I was in graduate school, my life would be completely different, because that's really what I'm interested in, how the Bible is received. So I'd been wanting to do something with Bible, but wasn't really sure how to do it, because I'm not a Bible expert. I'm in literature, and, you know, what could I do? And I thought this would be really interesting to have a volume where you have academics in different fields using their academic skills and talents to bear on the text, to say something about what the text is saying from the perspective of their fields. And if we could do this, that would be a good volume. So I wrote to Dr. Ruth's people, and it turns out her son went to the same high school that I went to, and I'd met her at Chautauqua, so I was able to get in touch with her, and I asked my father, who's a scientist of eating behavior, will be reading what he had to say, and my friend, the political scientist, and I was able to put together a volume. I want to start with this week's Parsha. I thought the rest of my time, I thought that I would teach you a little bit about what some of the essays actually have to say, because they're all very interesting in their own way. My goal, as I mentioned before, my goal in this volume was to engage people who might be intellectually inclined and not necessarily knowledgeable about Jewish texts, but also people that are interested in Jewish texts that want some kind of fresh, modern look at what the texts have to say. And we know that Chazal, our rabbis, teach their 70 faces to the Torah, their 70 ways to approach it. So I really see this as one of our modern ways of approaching the text. So this week, I'm sure everyone is aware, we've just started reading the book of Genesis. Last week was Bereishit. This week the Parsha is Noah. And at the end of the Parsha of Noah, Genesis 11, is the story of the Tower of Babel. So the story of the Tower of Babel is the story of multilingualism. How did we get so many languages? What came about that originally there was just Adam and Eve in Eden, just two people? Where did we get all these languages from? So this is an origin story of where this comes from. And the person that I thought would be perfect to write this is someone who's a JTS graduate and a multilingual scholar. So Ilan Stavins is a professor at Amherst. He has a very interesting biography. He grew up in Mexico City. He went to a Yiddish-speaking school, and I believe he spoke Yiddish at home. His father was an actor in one of Mexico's biggest soap operas. So very well-known actor. And so he grew up speaking Yiddish and Spanish, and then he spent time in Israel, and then he came to JTS for graduate school, I think his master's, I'm not sure, after that. So he, Yiddish, Spanish, Hebrew, English. So he is a multilingual scholar, and what's really amazing about him is that he writes and publishes in all these fields. Any of you who follow, the Jewish Book Council has a blog about new books, and just a couple days ago on their website, something was posted about a new collection that Ilan Stavins has done about Latin American Jewish stories. So in Latin America, I think, I'm not going to get the numbers quite right, but maybe there's 450 million people, and Jews are maybe a half of 1% of that. It's a very small number compared to the overall population of Latin America, but Jews have had a tremendous impact on the culture. And about 25 years ago, he put together an anthology called Tropical Synagogues, which is a great title, of short stories of Jews from Latin America. And he's put together a new one just now, so it's just coming out this month, next month. So he works on writers in Latin America, Jewish writers in Latin America. He's written a book called Spanglish about the intermixing of English and Spanish, because there are a lot of native Spanish speakers that live here in America and mix in a lot of English with their Spanish, and it's become a whole new dialect, Spanglish, and he's also written on Hebrew and Jewish literature. So he really is a multilingual scholar. And so he wrote an essay that was taken from a book of his on Hebrew about the Tower of Babel. So this is the first one on the page. So he asks, should multilingualism be castigated? The text itself is perplexing. I pointed out that in Drashot HaRav, Rabbi Nissim ben Reuven Gerandi, also known as the Ran, a 14th century Spanish scholar, stated, this has been the Jewish experience in our present exile. For when religious persecution began in the territory of Ishmael, the Muslim nations, its refugees were able to flee to the territory of Edom, Christian Europe, and from Edom to the territory of Ishmael. And this reinforces us us a little in the time of our affliction and servitude. Hence, exile and polyglotism are synonymous. So what he's saying here is, just as in the Tower of Babel, being forced to go to other places forced people to use different languages, so too in the 14th century this rabbi is saying that Jews are forced into polyglotism with exile. So I thought that was sort of an interesting take on the experience. He has a number of other things to say, but we'll stop there with that. So, and then the rest of the next few texts on the page are from last week's Parsha. I figured since we're at the very beginning, we can still, even though we read it last week, we can still discuss things from the first Torah portion of Genesis. So Dr. Westheimer wrote, "Yes, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was sex. From the first chapters of the book of Genesis, God's introduction to humanity, it's apparent that here is a theology spanning from the dawn of history that accounts for psychology, sexology, and human passion. The Bible, the story of how men and women first came to know God, and the Talmud, the canonized commentary on the Bible, is also the story of how men and women came to know each other." So I think that's a very interesting perspective. Obviously, she's very aware of how difficult it is for people to get to know each other. Just as it's difficult for us to understand the text, it's also difficult for people to get together. But I think that's an important perspective that we need to be aware of, that some of what is discussed in Genesis is about people coming to know each other. So the next essay I want to talk about, I'm honored that the author, Harry Kisseleff, is here. He's a someone who's a physiological psychologist. He studies eating behavior, and he wrote an essay about what we know. So he started a society for the study of ingestive behavior, right, how we ingest food. So what we know scientifically about eating and why people eat and how they eat and what motivates them to eat. So there's all kinds of scientific research about that. So he took all of that scientific research and applied it to the story of Adam and Eve. And tries to see how what we know today about eating behavior can help illuminate something about the text. So he writes, this is the third portion on the page, the third text on the page. "In laboratories throughout the world, scientists like myself are studying the properties of foods and beverages along with internal physiological states of individuals whose behaviors are either normal or disordered in order to understand how to improve products, create demand, or provide treatment for disease. All these studies are based on elements found in our story. It must also be noted that some kind of motivational apparatus must have been built into brains of our biblical ancestors, which impelled them to partake of these trees. Overcoming temptation is a problem that is still with us, but which is a necessary part of what makes us human." So I think that's a very helpful perspective of what we know about eating behavior, that there's some kind of motivational apparatus, there's something in the brains of people that makes them desire to partake of certain kinds of fruit, whether it's how it looks, how it smells. There are all kinds of cues that we have that scientists study that make people want to eat. And of course, it's still a problem. How do you overcome that temptation? So it's a very interesting essay. I highly recommend that everybody run to the book and read that first. It was one of the first ones written. It was a little tough to edit, but we're still talking to each other, right? Okay, so the next essay that I want to discuss is by a political scientist who teaches at NYU. And he wrote a very interesting book called Biblical Games. And what he did in this book, Biblical Games, was he took game theory, so how we game theory, sort of analyzing from a rational and logical point of view what each of the actors in a story is doing. So he was one of the first people to take this idea of how we can rationally analyze a story and see what each of the actors in the story might, what the choices, he has a lot of really interesting diagrams where he branches off, this person has this motivation and they could do this, they could do this, they could do this, and what that leads them to. So he applies this game theory to the biblical text. So it's an entire book about that, and I took the first chapter about Genesis to illustrate that. And he had some very interesting things to say. And it's, again, this is a field that most of us don't know very much about, and it's really fascinating to learn something about this field, as well as what this field has to say about the text. So he writes, his name is Stephen Brams, "Game theory, in my opinion, is a tool ideally suited for penetrating the complex decision-making situations often described in the Bible, because its application requires the careful unraveling of a tangle of character motivations and their effects. It imposes a discipline on the study of these situations that's usually lacking in more traditional literary, historical, theological analyses of the Bible. Understanding requires organization, and organization is given by a theory. God's preference for man with free will over man as a puppet perhaps requires further justification, especially in light of the grief and anguish that man later caused God. God wanted man to pay him homage, but that homage was heartfelt, not forced or dictated." So he analyzes the story and he talks about the motivations for each actor in the story and says that the reason why Eden was set up the way it was is that it made more logical sense for God to prefer a human being with free will over a human being who would be a puppet and just be servile to whatever commands God has to say. That it's a much more meaningful kind of obedience if it comes out of free will and out of choice, so that even if humans fail the test, as they do many times and continue to do, it makes much more rational sense for God to create a world in this way. So it's a very interesting essay that I recommend. The next essay is by a historian at UCLA, and he wrote a very interesting book called Bloodlust. Great title, about fratricide. So essentially, the Cain and Abel story is a paradigm for all kinds of other historical conflicts, and he does a fascinating job illuminating throughout history in a number of different situations, the Huguenots in the Renaissance, a number of other situations and cultures, how fratricide is really the most harmful and serious kind of threat to a society. So that Cain and Abel he sees as a paradigm for all kinds of other conflicts throughout history. So I took his essay from the introduction to his book, and he writes, "It is not so much the unknown that threatens us, but the known. We disdain and attack our brothers, our kin, our acquaintances, our neighbors whom we know well, perhaps too well. We know their faults, their beliefs, their desires, and we distrust them because of that. The most common form of violence is violence between acquaintances or neighbors or kindred communities within nations. Civil wars writ large and small." So I thought, this is, this is really a fascinating perspective, that Cain and Abel is really a paradigm for all kinds of other conflicts, and that the most serious conflicts in a society are those between people that are the most closely related. So I thought that that was a really worthwhile take on the Cain and Abel story. Another essay I didn't include it here on the text for you, but I'll read to you, that I really found extremely illuminating, is an essay by a psychologist who studies facial recognition. And in his essay, he was a colleague of mine at Carleton in Minnesota. His name is Seth Greenberg. And what he talks about is what makes it possible for people to recognize faces. So how is this important for Genesis? When Joseph's brothers go to the Egyptian court and stand in front of the second in command to Pharaoh, what is their problem? Why is it that they don't see this is their brother? Yes, it's been a number of years, But could he have really changed that much? Why, standing right in front of him, why didn't they know who this person was? What was wrong with them? So what he says we know about facial recognition, and what really makes a lot of sense, is that if you're not looking for something, you can't see it. And if they were looking at him and expecting an Egyptian, that's what they saw. Probably he had some kind of headdress. Maybe he had coal on his eyes and some kind of makeup to look Egyptian. He was dressed as an Egyptian. He had to speak through translators to them. And there was no reason for them to think that this was actually their brother in front of him. And in fact, there's a fascinating midrash that Joseph's brothers didn't believe that he was actually Joseph until he reveals himself to them by showing them that he's circumcised. So that's a very bare, to pun, a very bare need for him to really make himself vulnerable to his brothers and let them know, it's me, I'm your brother. But they're so unable to recognize him because they're just not expecting it. So what he says about facial recognition and what makes it possible for one to recognize a face is this. He says, successful or failed face identification, because it demands a perceiver's contribution, often reveals something about the perceiver. Thus, put simply, when faces in the biblical narrative are recognized or not recognized, and expressions are correctly or incorrectly interpreted, the reader learns about the skill, personality, and motivations of the one who is doing the perceiving. So I'll repeat that. The reader learns about the skill, personality, and motivations of the one who is doing the perceiving. So the one who's perceiving, the brothers, don't have, obviously, the motivation, right? It's much more convenient for them to think that their brother is safely out of harm's way and is never going to get his revenge on them, if at all possible. So they don't really have a motivation to want to identify this Egyptian vizier as their brother Joseph. So for me, that was one of the most illuminating essays in the book, because it really changed the way I thought about the text. I thought, well, okay, you know, this really makes sense. They just couldn't see who they was. They weren't willing to see him. And the reason why I brought up the Midrash is because he really had to force them to see him. He had to really show them, I am your brother, for them to be able to perceive him the way he is, as a Hebrew, not as an Egyptian. And it's a very difficult thing for both sides to grasp that perception. Another essay that's connected with Joseph and his brothers is by an ethicist who's at Yeshiva University, Moses Pava, and he talks about forgiveness between Joseph and his brothers. And he says, the narrative that we have in Genesis is one where Joseph and his brothers are engaged in a process that will at best produce imperfect forgiveness. All forgiveness is imperfect from a human perspective. In real life, the process of jointly reinterpreting the significance and meaning of past events to promote reconciliation between victim and perpetrator is never fully complete. Forgiveness is always uncertain, incomplete, and fragile. So I find this perspective very interesting, this reinterpreting the significance and meaning of past events to promote reconciliation between victim and perpetrator is really what Joseph is all about. If you remember at the end of Genesis, after Jacob has died, the brothers say to him, please don't get revenge on us. Our father told us that we should tell you not to take revenge on us. And we know very clearly this is not in the pshat of the Torah. This is not the plain sense of the Torah. The Torah never tells us that Jacob gave any such instruction to the brothers. It's something we'd expect to see, perhaps, but it never happens. So we can either assume that they're lying, or the Torah didn't choose to tell us that. But I think that the basic sense of the text is the brothers are lying. They are scared of what Joseph will do to them. And Joseph says to them, what's wrong with you? You may have felt that you were doing harm to me. You may have intended all of this. This is in Genesis chapter 50. I think it's verse 19 or 20. You intended to do evil to me, but God turned it around, and God intended all this for good. God sent me to sustain this whole people. And, you know, whatever your intentions were, whether they were for evil, it really didn't matter, because God made it possible for this all to turn out well, for the good. And Joseph is really saddened that his brothers think that he's going to get revenge. You know, after all this, haven't they learned anything about him and who he is? The thing is, they still can't see him for who he is, right? They still refuse to see him as a Jew like them, probably a better Jew because he's willing to forgive, but they still see him as an Egyptian seeking revenge. And it's a very poignant moment. So that's another essay that's very interesting. Connected with Jacob and his character development, I'm going to finish here with two pieces about Jacob. Is an essay by the novelist Dara Horn, who is also a Prose Door graduate. I don't know whether she was a valedictorian or not, but she's accomplished a lot since then. She's the author of four novels, most recently a novel called A Guide to the Perplexed, which has Maimonides and Solomon Schechter as characters. Has a lot of very interesting material in it. So as a practicing novelist, she writes from her perspective about character development, and she talks about the character development of Jacob. And she says, "One of the hardest things about writing novels is character development. The contemporary novelist's greatest challenge, then, is not only the creation of a plausible world, but the more difficult task of creating at least one character who can move through this world in a dynamic way that allows him or her to emerge at the end of the narrative as someone different, or, if stubbornly the same, then at least as a person the reader sees differently than he or she was at the beginning." So if we think about this for Jacob, right, Jacob is someone who emerges at the end of the narrative as someone different. Now, if we think of Jacob at the end of the narrative, if you remember, at the end of his life in Genesis 48, he goes to see the Pharaoh, and Pharaoh asks him, "Please bless me." So you'd think here he is before his son's boss, the person that saved this whole family and made sure that they could all come down to Egypt and have enough to eat and sustain themselves. You'd think he would say something, "I'm so grateful to you, and I'm really glad you recognized my son's talent, and you're terrific, and I'm so glad to be here in Egypt." What does he say? Jacob says to Pharaoh, "Few and bitter have been the years of my life." It's a very strange thing to say, but this is his character development. He becomes someone who's very bitter at the end of his life. And what's important about that, and I think that's an important way to think about the character of Jacob. Jacob and Joseph are really the most developed characters in Genesis, I would say. They're the characters that we see over time. We see the development of their character. We see them in a number of situations. And I think it's very important to think about how characters develop and change over time. So the final essay that I want to talk about is by a professor of public health. He was trained as an anthropologist. He did his doctoral work in New Guinea, which is kind of an interesting thing for a Jewish kid from New York, but he went to New Guinea, and he currently works in public health, and he studies attitudes of modern people about dying. What do modern people think about dying? What kinds of attitudes? How do they cope with death and with grieving? And he wrote about the death story in chapter 50 between Jacob and his sons from what we know about what actually happens from a survey of modern Americans today about attitudes to death. And what he has to say, this is the last quote on the sheet that I've given you. He says, "Jacob does a lot of talking before he dies, but none of it about the key event affecting the fate of his sons. The sons listen, but never raise the central issue. The silence is an eloquent testimony to the inability of many families to connect at the end of life." So what I mentioned before about the sons and Joseph never discussing the fact that they sold their brother Joseph into slavery, and they held up his cloak with blood on it and asked their father whether he recognized the cloak, and they didn't lie and say this is Joseph's cloak, but they didn't correct him when he assumed that it was Joseph's cloak and that the blood on it was Joseph. So they did not lie to him directly, but they allowed him to believe that this was the case. And for the 18 years that he was separated from Joseph, they didn't apologize to Jacob. They didn't say, we shouldn't have done this. You'd think that there would be some kind of deathbed scene where they would say, look, Joseph, we're really sorry. We shouldn't have done this. We didn't mean to. We thought that it would be for the best if you weren't in the family anymore because you were the favorite and we just wanted you out of the way. But we know now that was wrong. None of that happened. And the truth is, as Steve Albert saw from serving People About Death today, people don't have those difficult conversations at the end of life. It's just, in many cases, too difficult to talk about what's really important, what's really bothering you. And you could imagine it would have been a great comfort to Jacob to know, I'm sure some of you are familiar with the Midrash, about Jacob starts prophesying about the end of days and giving a blessing to his sons, and he stops. It's a strange passage. So why is he talking about the end of the days of days, and why does he stop? The Midrash says because he saw the disunity that was going to happen to his sons. He realized that there were going to be all kinds of limitations and places where they couldn't communicate. So if Jacob never had that moment of reconciliation where all the sons could come together and he would know, okay, we can go out forward as a unified people. He never has that moment, and it's a very sad way to think about them. They have to stay in Egypt for all those years and be enslaved because it takes that time for them to be forged as a people and for them to act as a collective whole. They really can't. There's another essay called Judah as the Leader of the Pride by another political scientist, Vernon Levine, whose father, Mort Levine, went to JTS, about collective action and why Judah is the perfect leader for taking this collective action, why he's the one that's able to become the leader of the brothers. So there's never this moment where they can all act together. It takes this time in slavery in the land of Egypt, and finally the Exodus, for them to act as a people. But if they just had some kind of reconciliation at Jacob's deathbed, maybe they wouldn't have had to be enslaved all those years. They could have gotten out earlier. They could have acted as a group, but they can't. So I just want to suggest to you that this is a new way of looking at the Bible, taking these ideas about how we can see things that are from different points of view, but how things, even if they may not on the face of them seem to be related to the Bible, can be used to illuminate different aspects of the Bible and uncover them that we might not see otherwise. So I just want to invite you to be a partner of mine and my other writers in reading Genesis. You may be surprised at how fascinating the Bible can be and what you can learn from modern writers on the ancient text. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions. I should also add that I'm working on a Reading Exodus volume. I have one of my future contributors who's an architect here who is going to write about architecture in the book of Exodus. I'm very excited about that, Ellie Levy. But anyone who knows of anyone who might, this is how I get, you were asking how I get the contributors. Anyone who knows of anyone or has any ideas of people, I don't want rabbis and Jewish scholars. We know that rabbis and Jewish scholars can write about the Bible and they have wonderful things to say. But what I'm trying to do is get people from different perspectives who want to say something about the Bible. So I'm happy to take any suggestions or ideas. But please, questions. Yes?
So some of the chapters are pieces that were written for other purposes.
Yes, yes.
And others were written for this volume?
Yes, yes.
So
both.
The ones that were written for other purposes, did you find those first? Did you identify them and then approach the authors for permission? How did that work?
Yes, yes, yes.
So you did a lot of research.
I did a lot of research. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. You were asking me if I still have academic pursuits, so yes.
Yes, got it.
I always do research, yes. Okay. So just various ways I heard about different books. I saw this book, Bloodlust, about Cain and Abel. I thought, wow, that's great. That's perfect. I got a copy of it. I read it. I got in touch with the author. I picked out the passage.
And when you suggested the biblical connection to some of the authors, were they kind of surprised? Like, what does this have to do with a biblical story or something? Or did it make sense to them?
No, everything. Oh, things that have been written already. Right. Obviously, they had written about some kind of biblical connection. But no, some of the authors were surprised, but some of them were kind of eager to have a format mm-hmm. to work out ideas that they'd been thinking about, like my friend, the political scientist who gave a Devar Torah at his synagogue. You know, he gives Devar Torah from time to time. It's something he's interested in, but he never took the time to sit down and really work things out about his argument in a well-researched fashion. Mm-hmm. So some of them were happy, and my friend, the anthropologist who studies public health, also active Jew member of his community, so interested in having an opportunity, sort of forcing him to work out ideas in a way that he hadn't in longer form. So if they're going to say yes, it's something that they're interested in. So really, it wasn't me, it's Tanakh. You know, it's that they're interested in studying and thinking about Tanakh. And the contributors have various levels of Jewish education, but I checked what they had to say, and I thought everything was fine and made sense. Or I suggested, why don't you read this? Why don't you read that? This might be interesting to you. So that's a great question. Thank you. Yes.
Horace Mann, class 74.
All right. I hope you're as ashamed as I am.
Were there people that you asked from different disciplines who were not successful? I'm not asking ad hominem, but were
yeah,
there people
absolutely.
That you asked
yeah.
It just didn't work.
Yeah.
You didn't include it.
Yeah, yeah,
what
yeah.
Were those disciplines.
Absolutely. Oh. Well, you know, I mean, there are also things I didn't even think about. I was thinking about, oh, this week's Parsha, it's Noah. I should have asked someone who's an expert on animal taxonomy and classification. That would have been really fun. Why didn't I do that? You know, and I should have had someone who's in physics or talk about the Big Bang and creation. But there are a lot of people that have written about things like that, so I didn't feel that was new. I'm trying to think if there were things that were, you know, that I really wanted someone and I was unsuccessful, but I can't think. I mean, there are things that I'm trying for this next volume, like I was talking with David Kramer. If you saw recently in the Sunday New York Times book review, a what would you call him, a food expert mm-hmm. and a food expert and chef, Dan Barber, wrote a wonderful, wonderful piece about Shemitah and conservation techniques on the land. And I thought, oh, I would really love to have that in my Exodus volume, and they turned me down. But I think I may still try to pursue them. Or I really want to have Julian Zelizer, who's a political scientist at Princeton and whose father is a conservative rabbi, write something for the Exodus volume about politics. But he said no. But I think I might try him again. You know, my deadline keeps changing. So he said at the time I asked him no. But you know, I'd really love to have him. The people I would really love for the Exodus volume, I would love to get Elena Kagan or Ruth Bader Ginsburg to say something about justice and Exodus and enforcing law and what it means to enforce law. And Ruth Ginsburg has just published a volume of her speeches, and I looked through it and there really wasn't anything that I thought I could use, but I think I still might try. I'm trying to weasel my way in somehow to get, so I haven't gotten those people, but I can't think for Genesis of anyone that I really wanted that I didn't get. I was pretty happy. It's a very diverse group of people, and that was really something I wanted. And I will say also, my intention was only to have Jews write, and there was someone that I asked who has a last name that's one of these names where they're Jews with the name, non-Jews with the name, you don't really know, and he wrote something that I really liked, and I said, I heard him speak, and can I have this for the volume? And he said yes. And then I sent him some material about the book, and I'd said something about Jewish scholars, and he wrote back, I'm not Jewish. And I said, oh. He said, but my wife and my children are. So I thought, okay, you know, I'm not establishing this as a halachic standard here. You know, that's fine with me. I'm not going to tell you who it is. You know, we'll keep you if you are perpetuating the Jewish community and concerned with teaching Jewish values to your children. That's fine. Stay in. So maybe he'll convert yet. Who knows? Maybe that acceptance. Yes.
To what extent did any of the writers push back on your editing?
Yeah, no, most of them were fine. I didn't really have to do a lot of editing. There was actually one, I won't say who has written extensively in, I can't use a gender pronoun, but in a field, and I expected to get something much more interesting and at a higher level, and I said, well, maybe you could do this, or you could read that, and I went back and forth. In the end, I just accepted it. And so, you know, not every single essay is at the level that I'd hoped it would be, but most of them are. I was, in general, pleased. So, no, I'm not a difficult editor, I promise you. You're going to be fine. But no, that's a good question. I feel, and, you know, someone asked me also whether there are any that I didn't agree with, and I said no, but I also, there was someone I was thinking of asking who published a book about Genesis, but was also on some political committees that I thought, I'm not really sure that I want to get involved with this person and what he signals, so I'm not going to ask him, and that was fine. I had enough without, so I really, but I also asked people from a broad range of religious and obviously someone who isn't Jewish, but religious affiliations, and I'm really pleased that it's a very pluralistic, that it really, I think that it really shows that one can learn something from everyone, as Pirkei Avot teaches us. Yes?
Referring to the comment by Dr. Westheimer, I've been reading recently a work on circumcision in which...
By who?
Circumcision, of course, establishes...
Who wrote the book?
What?
Who wrote the book?
Shia J.D. Cohen.
Okay. So he's a JTS graduate?
Yeah. He's dean here in Brown. And in that, there are some statements that say since women, Jewish women, are not circumcised, they really aren't Jewish. Now, I believe it's Rabbi Joseph Bechor Shur and Rupert Aduitz have slightly different levels of opinion on. They both agree that the blood of menstruation being equivalent to the blood of circumcision establishes the covenant for women, but to different levels. So I'd be interested in your opinions on that.
I think biblically some people have made the argument that with the matriarchs, giving birth is the sign of the covenant, that all the matriarchs in Genesis are barren, and that when God finally, it says in Genesis 21, God remembered Sarah, that we read on Rosh Hashanah, that that's God's remembering of Sarah is the sign of the covenant for her. But I don't know that I'd want to extrapolate that to the modern day. But certainly in the Bible, women are part of the covenant. They may not have a physical external sign like Joseph to show to the world, but I don't think that they're any less part of the covenant. I think certainly, I think that that's the place in the biblical text. The matriarchs giving, after being barren, having the miracle of giving birth shows that they're involved in the covenant.
Would you know if Dr. Westheimer has ever delved into this subject at all, whether the covenant with the men with circumcision or women through the menstrual blood or simply through the act of birth is one of the covenants?
Well,
being
yeah, I did. I took this essay from a book she co-wrote with Jonathan Mark, who is an editor at the Jewish Week, whose wife is the alumni magazine person at Horace Mann. It's a very small world. So Ruth Westheimer and Jonathan Mark co-wrote a book, and we took her piece from that about, I can't remember the exact, it's probably in here, but sex in the Jewish tradition, something like that. So that's the place I would look. But she has a website. You can email her.
Sure, thank you.
She's a very...
I met her over at Temple Emmanuel. They had, what was it, Reading Genesis, and she was one of the...
Right, I was there.
Yeah.
I put the pal, but thank you for coming twice. I'm very honored that you came twice. Yes?
You mentioned Kagan and Ginsburg, and so let me ask a legal question.
Uh-oh, I'm not a legal scholar.
By the way, I know very little about the Bible. Brooklyn Tech, 1970. you mentioned before God giving human free will. Yet he goes and he punishes men for using this free will, whether it's Noah the flood, Moses, 40 years in the desert, whatever. How do you explain the entrapment situation, so to speak? That's the legal thing.
Right, no, it's obviously it's a complex question, but I would stick with what Stephen Bram said, that God needs humans to have free will so that they can be free actors, and humans can make mistakes. I don't have. I don't think it's entrapment. I think it's a choice.
Parents
I think
do the same thing all the time.
What?
Parents do the same thing. Kids free will, but they get in trouble if they
right. Right. You've used that phone more than the certain allocated hours, I'm taking it away. But you know, I'm leaving the cookies out, but if you eat too many, I'm gonna take them away. So I don't see it as entrapment, I see it as a learning curve. As you say about the analogy with parents, I think there are ways to be educated. And in fact, one really interesting take on the Joseph story, there's a professor in Israel, Oriel Simon, who's written about Joseph's education of his brothers, that what he's doing with them, putting one in jail and putting the next one in jail and accusing him of stealing the goblet, is actually educating them so that they will learn to repent. And if when we come to the Parsha of Vayigash, when Judah gives the, in Genesis 44 and 45, Judah gives this moving speech to Joseph and says how upset their father is with everything that's happened, and he doesn't want their father to suffer anymore, and he's not going to leave this brother to languish here in the Egyptian jail. That shows that he's in the same situation, right? Maimonides' definition of repentance is if you're in the same situation and you make a better choice, you make the right choice, you've fully done repentance. So that all of the things that Joseph's done are to educate his brothers so that they will be able to show that they've fully repented. Although I'd like to argue that at the end of Jacob's life, when they're still worried about Joseph's getting revenge on them, they may have repented, but they don't think that Joseph has, so maybe they haven't fully repented. But I think that that's an important perspective, is that throughout the Bible, humans are educated. I think that's part of what it's about. I think there was one more question. Is there?
Sure.
Was there another hand? Oh, no. Okay.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Again, thank you for coming. There are a few copies of the book that are available for purchase, so you can pay the author directly, and I'm sure she will be happy to sign copies for you. Let me just say that this is part of an ongoing series of book talks. The next one that we will be featuring is early next month, Mel Skolt. Is a scholar of the diaries of the life and work of Mordechai Kaplan. And he is just published the next volume of those journals relating to Kaplan's observations leading up to and during the Second World War, the Holocaust. So it'll be fascinating material, and you're invited to come back at the time. We have your emails, I assume, and so you will hear about that. Thank you again for coming.